This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Is the following. When you will come to the land which the Rabbeinu Sholem is giving to you, and you will inherit it and be settled in it, and you will say then, I want to put a king over me in the same way as do all the nations around and about me, then you must indeed appoint a king who God will choose. He'll be one of your own people. You can't give a stranger, that means a non-Jew, as a king. You can't place him as a king, anybody who's not achicha, who's not one of you. Then we are told, so we've got here a mitzvah. The mitzvah is to appoint a king, but the mitzvah is conditional. When does the mitzvah apply? Only after such time. Two conditions. Number one, you've already inherited the land. Number two, when you ask for it. So it requires the will of the people to bring into effect the mitzvah. Once the people will it, it becomes a mitzvah to do it. The Rishonim battle a little bit over this, what it is exactly. Some say it's no mitzvah at all. It's just a concession, really. The same as the Eishet Yifat Torah. Like the Torah says in the one of the coming sedras. If you go to war and you're in the middle of battle, etc., etc., and there's a very beautiful woman and so on, you can bring her home and you do certain things to her, and ultimately, if you still want her, you can marry her. And the Gemara tells us that that's keneged Yetzer Hora Dibra Torah, that the Torah is making a concession to the Yetzer Hora, like Lahavdil Elef Avdolos, like the Catholics do with marriage in general. And the Catholics say marriage is a terrible thing, but no, the Yetzer Hora needs it and all the rest of it, rather marriage than the rest of it. That's how they do it with marriage. We say no, marriage is a mitzvah. And a very important mitzvah too. But there are mitzvahs in the Torah which are in fact concessions to the Yetzer Hora. Nobody would say it's an ideal to marry an Eshes Yifas Torah, to marry one of these women who brought back from war. But if it happens, the Torah tells you how to handle it. Then there's another kind of mitzvah. Some say this is like that, but that's discarded by most Rishonim. Some say it's a mitzvah like eating meat. You're permitted to eat meat if you want to, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But if you do it, this is the way to do it. This is the way you've got to shech the animal. And they say the same here. If you want a king, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. If you don't want a king, there's also nothing wrong with it. And if you want a king, this is the way he must be appointed. David Fenster, Shalom Aleichem. The third way of learning it is, no, it's actually a mitzvah to make it, to appoint a king, and that's the mashmos of the Gemara. That's how it appears from the Gemara, that it's one of the three mitzvahs which the Jews were given, that when you settle down in the land, one of the things you must do is appoint a king. However, it is conditional. You must first be settled, number one, and number two, you must want it before it's appointed. In other words, it becomes a chiyuv to want a king, really. That's how it is. And then we're told, so you must place a king. Three laws, specific laws, are given here about the king, three that we'll be concerned with. The one is, he mustn't have large quantities of horses. The horses here it's referring to in concept is really armory. They used to use the horses like they use tanks today. So in other words, he mustn't go and build up a ridiculously large army, because that will take him back to Mitzrayim, because Egypt is where they make all these things, and if you do deals with the arm manufacturers, then they've got a tremendous hold over you. And before very long, they're telling you what to give to the Arabs and what to keep, and they're dividing up your whole land before very long. So have nothing to do with them. And don't build up huge armies. Secondly, nothing to do with the first, not too many wives. Chazal tell us not too many means 18. For kings. You're a Kohen, you're out of this. And thirdly, money. Not too much money. Lo yabe lo ma'oid. You shouldn't be excessively rich. But as we see from the kings, they were rich. They had lots of money. The Torah is not talking against the king having money. But money shouldn't be an important thing in his life. In fact, all these three things should not be important things. Yes, his wives have to be important to him, but the collection of wives should not be important. The collection of armaments should not be important. And the collection of money should not be important. And he must write himself a Sefer Torah and learn out of it. That particular din we won't be dealing with this evening. Levilti rum, all this is levilti rum levavoy me'echov, so that despite all the honor we give a king, his heart doesn't rise up above his brothers. He has to handle himself in such a way which is above his brothers. We're going to see a little bit more of that in a moment. But his heart must never rise up above them. Levilti sum in a mitzvah yomin esmol, so that he never departs from the mitzvah left or right, right or left. Leman yarich yomim al mamlochtoi, so that he should have many days on his kingdom, on his throne. Hu uvanov bekerev Yisrael, he and his children amidst Israel. That's the piece of Chumash. The first question is the following. What's this whole big business about? When you come to the land and you will want a king, you may appoint a king, etc., etc. They have a king already. Moshe Rabbeinu has all the dinim of a king. And if Moshe Rabbeinu, if some will want to say that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't a proper king, there's no question that Yahushua was. That Yahushua had all the, when Yahushua was appointed immediately after Moshe Rabbeinu's death, long before they went into Eretz Yisrael, he had all the dinim of a king. To the extent that anybody who disobeyed him was Chayav Misa. If you disobeyed Yahushua, as if you disobey any king, it's a capital offense. The king is entitled to have you put to death immediately for disobeying, no matter how irrelevant the disobedience might appear to you. The king says, go to the shop and buy me a packet of cigarettes, and you don't go, he can shoot you. That's it. That's part of what a melech is. And that applied to Yahushua. So what's this whole thing? What is it that they're going to want that they don't already have? Secondly, and this is the obvious question which all the Mefarshim ask, the first question is the question of the Sipurna. Those of you who learned the Sipurna will have seen that as the question of the Sipurna. The second question emerges out of the chapter in Tanakh which deals with the coming to be of this din. It comes in Shmuel Aleph, chapter Chet, where they're ready, and we're told the following, Vayehi kasher zokein Shmuel. Shmuel, who had led the people magnificently as their Novi, their prophet, who in those times the prophet was also like a king, really. I mean, all the time, from Yahushua through the Shoftim, the Nevi'im, they'd always been kings. Call them Shoftim, call them Nevi'im, call them whatever you want to call them, but they had the full role of a king. Now, Shmuel was getting old. Vayosem es bonov Shoftim liYisrael. And he appointed his sons judges in Israel. Vayehi shem beno abachor Yoel, v'shem mishneyo Avio, Shoftim beve'er Shova. And the name of the Bechor was Yoel, and the second one was Avio. And they used to judge in Be'er Sheva. The loy holchu vonov biderochel, and they did not follow in the ways of Shmuel. Vayitu acharei habotza, and they followed bribery. Vayikhu shoichad, and they took bribes. Vayatu mishpot, and they bent law. Now the Gemara tells us, don't think for one minute that means that they took bribery. These are the sons of Shmuel Hanavi, the home they grew up into, with the values that were around them. You think the sons of Shmuel Hanavi would have taken a few pennies of bribery? That there's no question about that was never the case. And the Gemara points out further, it doesn't say they sinned, it says, V'lo holchu vonav bidrochel. They didn't follow the high standards of Shmuel. It doesn't say that they didn't follow the Torah. What does it mean then that they took shochad, they took bribery? Says the Gemara, Shmuel's greatness was he had a caravan. And I must tell you, after my last holiday, I understand why Shmuel had a caravan. It's the most wonderful thing. What's so wonderful about it is that you can get to wherever you want to, you can get there quickly, and when you arrive there, you don't need anything from anybody. That was the middle of Shmuel. He had his home wherever he went, he didn't need anything from anybody, and he went and judged them in their places. He went to see them in their communities. It's much easier to judge a person where he lives. It's much more effective. It solves a lot of problems on the part of the people who are being judged. And that was what Shmuel did. Although he was a godel b'Yisrael, he was the leader of the people of Israel. He used to climb into his little kombi, and off he used to go all over the place to see that everybody was judged in their own place. And the Gemara says his sons didn't. They set themselves up in Be'er Sheva, and they built a Beis Din there, they built a building there, and they established their homes there. And they weren't interested in any of this caravanning business. I suppose they were raised up as children in a caravan. I mean, you can imagine their childhood was going either without their father, who was always off in the caravan, or they were with him. Came the time when they were doing it, they obviously decided this was no right way to raise a family. They're living in Be'er Sheva, and for that they're criticized. The reason that they did so, they're told, was they felt they would like to encourage business in Be'er Sheva, that the secretary should have work to do there, and that their own staff should be properly occupied and should have work to do. That is considered on the part of the shofet, on the part of the dayan, that's already considered bribery. That means you are doing things not in the interest of the litigants. That means there is an aspect of your judging, of your decision making, where you're subjecting your decision making vis-a-vis an individual to a policy. That's not allowed. When you're a rov, when you're a shofet, when you're a dayan, you're dealing with individuals. And your decision has to be for the good of that individual. That's all. No policies. You don't subject individuals to policies. And that was the criticism against them. They had a policy. Let's build Be'er Sheva. Nobody will suffer. Somebody has to travel to go to the Beis Din. So why shouldn't it be the litigant? Why should it be the dayan? But that's not good enough. That's subjecting the interests of an individual to a general policy. That we never do. If you're a politician, yes, you can have policies. This is the way we do it. This is where everybody goes. This is the direction everybody takes. And that's it. But then you're a politician. If you're a rov or a dayan, then each person is an individual. They were spoiled now, Am Yisrael. They were used to having the judge coming to them. All of a sudden, they've got to go to the rov. That's no business. So they come to Shmuel, they take the opportunity. And they say to him, now you're getting old. And your children are not following, are not doing things the way you did them. Now give us a king to judge us like all the other nations have. Okay, that's what the Torah tells us they're going to say. Nothing wrong with that. And Shmuel takes a dim view of this request. Kasher Omru, as they said, give us a judge to judge us. Vayispayel Shmuel el Hashem, and Shmuel prays to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So what do we expect God to say to Shmuel? Shmuel, don't be silly, look in the Torah. Obviously, they're fully entitled to that. Give them their king. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, Shema Bekol Ha'am, exactly as we think he's going to say. Listen to the people, L'chol Asher Yomru Elecha, whatever they tell you to do, listen to it. Ki lo oischo mo'asu, because they are not rejecting you, Shmuel. You've got nothing to feel sore about. Ki oisi mo'asu mim loich aleihem. They've sacked me as their king, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, not you. Shmuel, they've got nothing against you. You don't have to worry. It's me they've sacked. It's ridiculous. And that is the mitzvah. And the way we've learned it, it's actually they have got to want a king. Now they're wanting a king, and the Ribbono Shel Olam says, oh, yeah, they're rejecting me. What is it? You know, it's not the same thing, but it almost appears like a Jewish mother who raises her son and tells him how, you know, you've got to get married one day and find yourself a nice girl and set up your own home, and comes the day, and he comes home and he says, mother, you know, I found a bride, and she bursts into tears. You're rejecting me? Am I not good enough? Aren't I looking after you? Okay, one can understand that that's part of motherliness, that's part of being a mother, the close relationship that one has. But for the Ribbono Shel Olam to get upset because they want a king when he's already built into his Torah provisions for a king, very difficult to understand. And this is the main question on the Parsha, which all the Rishonim, both in Tanakh and in the Chumash, ask. Now, why I want to learn this Parsha is to get some kind of understanding of the principle of Malchus. What is a king? Not what is a king legally. We can understand what a king is legally. But as we mentioned last night, two things we mentioned last night. The one is that out of every piece of Torah, we have to learn something which is relevant to ourselves and in fact can enrich our own lives. If we learn a piece of Torah and out of that we're not able to enrich our own lives, then we haven't really been mekayim the mitzvah. We haven't actually learned Torah properly. The mitzvah is lilmud amanas lasus. You've got to learn in order to do. So I can understand when I'm learning the laws of Shabbos, I'm learning in order to do. When I'm learning the laws of Kashrus, I'm learning in order to do. But when I learn the laws of a king, I must also learn in order to do. What can I do about the laws of a king? I'm not a king. Not so simple. There are certain principles, and if one is able to penetrate to the principles of any parsha in the Torah, one will find that those principles are applicable not only to the king of Israel, but to every one of us. And that's why I want to try and penetrate to the conceptual concept of what a king is. What is a king in concept? What's his essence? What is there about a king which we can use ourselves? Because we also mentioned last night that we're striving for a crown. We're all striving for the Keter Torah. We're all striving to reach the crown of Torah, which is the only crown available to us. That means we're striving to reach nobility and aristocracy through our learning of Torah. But then one has to understand, what is aristocracy? What does it mean to be a king? Because we're all trying to be kings in Torah. What does it mean? It doesn't just mean knowing the Torah. It means being a different person altogether. Now the Sipur answers the first question we asked. And in that he also answers this last question, the question of what is the essence of a king. Says the Sifurna, there will come a time when you will say, Asimu alai melech b'chol hagoyim. I want a king. What is a king, asks the Sifurna? Moshe is obviously not what you want. Yeshua is not what you want. The Shoftim are not what you want. Shmuel is not what you want. What is a king? Answers the Sifurna, Shetiheye hamalchus loy ulezaroy, that the malchus, the kingship, should be for him and his children. Should be hereditary. That's what a king is. Very strange. You've got a king like Moshe. You've got a king like Yehoshua. You've got a king like Shmuel and Ovi. Not satisfied. You want a king whose children will also follow. What difference does it make? The loike inyan ha-shoftim, and not like the shoftim, shehayo ha-shofet molech hu bilvad, where the shofet used to rule as a king, but he, only he, avaloi zaro acharov, but not his children afterwards. When the shofet died, they used to appoint a new one. And to appoint a shofet as a king in this way, they are commanded about when they come into the land, as it says, but that the king should be, the Am Yisrael who come into Eretz Yisrael should not be like a flock who doesn't have a shepherd. Interesting, there's a whole piece of Sipurna here which wasn't in my Chumash. I just want to, if you'll excuse me for 1 minute. It takes one of the views that I brought to you earlier, that the Ribbono Shel Olam does not like this idea of appointing a king forever. Right? That's not what he likes, but he makes a concession like the Yefas Tor. It's an absolute concession. His idea is that each generation should appoint their own shofet, and it should be only for that generation. Which is the correct version is something we'll have to go into a little bit to try and find out whether this is in fact what the Sifurna said, or there's a reason why it's been left out in other editions. So something that won't be so easy to find out. But I don't think that affects us terribly much. The point that I want to make, and we'll then move over to the other Rishonim, the Yesod that I want to take from here, is that what they were asking for, and it makes tremendous sense, in fact there's virtually no other way to understand it, that what they were asking for as opposed to what they had is a king that will pass his kingdom over to his children. That's what they want. And that's the mitzvah. Now it comes out, this is the difference. So the way the Sifurna actually learns it in this edition is that that's a concession. The way we're learning it according to most of the Rishonim is that it's a mitzvah. That you have to appoint a king. What does it mean appointing a king? Not a shofet and not a novi. Those are kings who only rule for their own lifetime. What you've got to appoint is a king that will hand over his kingdom to his future generation as well. That's the mitzvah to do. That emerges then, according to the Sifurna, as the essence of the melech, as opposed to the shofet or the novi. The essence of the melech is the Yerusha, the fact that he hands it over to others. The Rambam also learns that that's a very important part of the whole concept of melucha, of kingship, and he certainly learns that it's an ideal, that it's not a concession. That's how it should be. Comes the question, what's that so important? And why is that the essence of what a king is all about? Surely there are more esoteric concepts of what a king is. Now, a king is a man who hands his kingship over to his children. Furthermore, if the reason for this, that they're asking this, is because they want their princes raised as princes, in other words, you don't want a peanut farmer to become a king. And you want a person who's been raised from scratch to become a king. You want somebody who knew from childhood he was going to become a king. And has been trained for it and groomed for it and he knows what it is to be a king. That's what you want ideally. That's the simple way of learning the Sifurna. Then it's very difficult because the first king wasn't like that. Shaul wasn't like that. David HaMelech, the most outstanding of our kings, wasn't like that. The Mashiach probably won't be like that. And then it comes out that some of our most important kings don't fit into this category. It's true, they technically fit into the category because it's a hereditary kingship. But conceptually they don't. If the concept is that the child should be raised to be a king, then it comes out that some of our most important kings don't fit in. So I want to suggest that in fact the importance here is not for the child, but for the father. What we want, says the Sifurna, say Am Yisrael, what we want is a king who knows that his children will succeed him. That's what we want. And that will affect the way he'll rule. We're not worried about the raising of the children. We're prepared to appoint a king from scratch now, a new king, an adult. and he wasn't raised as a child, that's fine. But we want him to know that his children are going to be king. Why? Months before, quite a while ago, I gave a shiur on Malchus, on what kingship is. And we developed the idea of the Tel Zerov, that a king is a man who is able to see over the heads of his society. That's what a king is. A person is not bound and restricted by the norms of his society. He's bound and restricted by the Torah, and he's bound and restricted by his rabbeim, by the people who taught him Torah. But the other norms of society he's not bound by. Why? Because one has to make progress. Strides have to be made in every sphere of activity. One sees it today, one sees it in the areas of science and engineering. One sees the strides. If people would regard themselves in science as being bound by the norms of their society, you would never have had a Newton, you would never have had an Einstein. The ability of these people was to go totally beyond what their society accepted as normal, and to investigate areas far beyond that. And there are many people who do that. Some of them are cranks and they don't get anywhere, and some of them are great and they break new barriers, and then that becomes accepted as the norm. The tendency, says the Tel Zerov, is for any normal person to be tremendously sensitive to the power of the influence of his society. His society determines what's right and what's wrong, what you can do and what you can't do. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't say you can't do that, but your society says you can't do it, so you don't do it. And your society says you can do this, it doesn't say in Shulchan Aruch that you can do it. Your society says it's alright, everybody's doing it, so you do it. A king is a man who's able to see right over all that. And his contacts are him, the Torah, his Rabbein going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So he's connected to God, so to say, backwards, but in front of him he sees nothing. Just open horizons. He can go anywhere. As long as he keeps on holding to his tradition, as long as he keeps on holding to what he's got behind him, he doesn't see anything that's standing in front of him. We normal human beings just have to work our way in between everybody. And that's why we do all sorts of cockeyed things. We hold on to the past and we try and hold on to the future, and we edge ourselves between everyone in the present. And of course you can't break new horizons that way. A king is a person who holds on to the past and he breaks into new barriers. He establishes new areas. He investigates new possibilities. He doesn't regard his vision as being restricted by the norms of the society in which he lives. That's Malchus. Now what do the two going to do with one another? The Tel Zerov, I can understand that that's kingship. That's romantic. That's something which is noble. That I can understand. That's something I want to strive for. But to strive for office that I can pass over to my children. But what is the office? No, there's a tremendous connection. The thing you need most of all in order to be able to face clear horizons is confidence. That's it. You've got to know that what you're doing is right. You know, you learn to fly an aeroplane. So you get into the aeroplane. As long as you've got a horizon in front of you, it's easy. You can see whether you're flying straight. You can see whether you're crooked, you can see if you're going north, south, east or west. Even if you don't have a compass, even if all your instruments break down, you'll probably get yourself to ground safely. It's not the end of the world as long as you can see the horizon. And you can see familiar things around you. Now, there's that building and there's the Brixton Tower and there's the Hillbrow Tower. Oh, therefore the airport must be there, and you turn around and you go there. It's not very difficult. But when you get into a cloud, you've got no horizon and no Brixton Tower and no Hillbrow Tower, and you don't know where you are. There's only one thing that's going to get you to ground: confidence. You've got to be absolutely sure that you know where you're going, because if you start doubting, maybe I'm going south when I should be going north, then you're finished. Maybe I'm tilting too much to the left when I should be tilted to the right, or I should be straight, then you're finished. And they tell you that then your life expectancy is in fact 2 minutes. That's it, because you're going to get yourself into such a spin that you won't be able to get yourself out of it, because you'll start correcting and doing all sorts of funny things, and you'll never make a stride, you'll never get out of it. If you don't have horizons, and if you don't have the familiar landmarks, if you want to break into new areas, you have to have absolute confidence. In the case of flying, it's confidence in your instruments. In the case of Torah, it's confidence in your understanding of Torah and your connection with your past, with your tradition. It's confidence in your Rabbeim, confidence in your father, confidence in those who've taught you Torah. You have supreme confidence in them, plus your understanding of Torah, and with that you can face a clear horizon. But if you start dilly-dallying and you're not sure, are you doing it right, and should you go that way or should you go that way, then best come down to ground and do what everybody else is doing, because that's much safer. And you can't go terribly far wrong if you do what everybody else is doing. So you won't reach any great heights, but you won't go wrong. If you're up there in the clouds, then you've got to be sure that where you're going is right. A king needs confidence, and for confidence you need security. You mustn't worry about the I must please the electorate. You know, okay, maybe I'm in for life, but what about my children? Now, you can't exactly send the prince out to work as an accountant. And if the prince is not going to be a king, then he has no future. A king can't afford to be worried about that at all. He has to know that he and his children and his children's children are here to stay, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And that's why Shmuel HaNavi, in the next chapter, comes to Am Yisrael and says, look, I'll give you a king if you want one. But please just understand what you're letting yourselves in for. He can tax you. He can take your children into the army. He can kill you. He can do what he wants to you. And you can't impeach him. You can't get rid of him, nor of his children, nor of his children's children. It's your choice whether you want a king or not. But what you're choosing is a king, a master, that will master you for now and forever. And there's nothing you can do to relieve the mastery of that king over you. That's what you're letting yourselves in for. And for that kind of... to be able to break new barriers, a king has to know that he doesn't have to please anybody. He has to please the Ribono Shel Olam. That's all. He doesn't have to please his ministers. He doesn't have to please his people, his electorate, the press. Nothing. He is absolutely impervious to any kind of destructive statements or destructive ambitions by anybody around and about him. That's what being a king requires. In other words, the Sipurna has told us what a king needs in order to fulfill his function. He needs absolute security, because his function is one that requires courage. And for courage you need security. Let's look at another example of the security of a king. Before I go to do that, I'll just show you a little Gemara in Brochus, which actually shows how David HaMelech used to operate. The Gemara tells us in Daf Dalet, Kol ma she'ani oseh ani nimlach b'mefivoshes rabbi. Whatever I do, I consult Mephibosheth, my Rebbe, says David HaMelech. And I'm not ashamed to do so. So you think that's opposite to what we've just learned. What kind of a king is this? Always consult his Rebbe, then his Rebbe is the king. And I say to him, Mephibosheth, Rebbe, Mephibosheth, my Rebbe, Yofe Danti, Yofe Chiyavti, have I judged correctly? Have I obligated correctly? Yofi Zochisi, have I merited correctly? Yofi Tiharti, have I made something kosher correctly? Yofi Timesi, have I made something treif correctly? It's in the past tense. He paskens first, and then he checks. Right, so he goes into his new areas with confidence, but always hanging on to his Rebbe, almost always making sure that he's following a tradition which has been handed down to him, and goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. With that tradition clear, that he's followed a clear tradition and confidence in that tradition, a tradition which he keeps up throughout his life without shame. That's fine. He doesn't consult anybody else. He doesn't consult his Beis Din. He doesn't consult his Rabbonim. He doesn't consult his ministers. He doesn't consult Parliament. Now, all he has to know is that what he's saying is not out of line with his tradition. Then he doesn't care what the mainstream is, and then he doesn't care what the fashions are, and then he doesn't care what the people expect of him or want of him. Then he does what he believes is right. That's it. Another example of this we have with Yosef. I was asked by a business, a company, a manufacturing company recently, the following question. They had made an incredible breakthrough in a new product. A brand new product, a completely new concept, which put them miles and miles ahead of all their competitors. The only trouble is that if their competitors were ambitious enough, it would take them exactly 2 weeks to copy. So they had 2 weeks head start on their competitors. Now the following was the question. It was very important for their consumers, who were in fact worldwide, to know that this company was on the ball and was ahead of everybody else. The only way they felt they could do that would be to advertise. There had to be statements in the press worldwide that this breakthrough had been made. Very simple. So far, so good. The question is, when the competitors see that advert in the paper, what are they going to do? And the decision was, as important as it is for the consumers to know about the breakthrough, it mustn't be publicized. And I asked them, I said, do you mean to say you're going to manage to keep it away from your competitors? How long is it going to take your first consumer to pick up the phone to your competitors and say, you know what they're offering? No, they said, that doesn't matter. It doesn't present my competitors with such a challenge. When I put it in the paper, I'm challenging them to catch up, and they'll take the challenge. If I don't put it in the paper, I'm not challenging them, and it'll take them a few weeks or a few months longer for them to catch up. That's very sound reasoning. So the decision was that they weren't going to advertise. One can understand that. You're insecure. What does Yosef do? Yosef is also a king, right? You'll remember that Paro says, when he's criticized for appointing a slave as a king, He says, Gevane Malchus Re'ani Boya, see signs of kingship in him. This is a king, this isn't a slave. What does Yosef do? He dreams about kingship. He dreams that he's going to be a king. And he dreams it twice. So he goes and he tells his brothers. A bit of seichel on the surface, it appears, one needs. What do you want to do? Make your brothers angry? Get them to back up also and become kings as well, and then there'll be a fight for royalty for who will be the king. Keep it to yourself. You've dreamt that you've been appointed king. Okay. You've dreamt that they're going to bow down to you. Okay. Why start all sorts of nonsense? No, he tells them. Says the Medrash. Vayachalom Yosef chalom. Yosef dreamt a dream. Vayomer aleihem, and he said to them, Shimono, listen please. Omar, he said to them, Kach yiyu hanaviim moichichim eschem. In the same way as I am rebuking you with the words Shimono, that's how the prophets in the future are going to be rebuking your descendants. What's the rebuke? Where is he rebuking? Why should I be the king? What's wrong with you? Why have you people slipped up? Why am I ahead of you? Why am I better off than you? Why is the Ribbono Shel Olam chosen me and not you? Back up and pick yourselves together and see that you become the kings. Why should it be me? That's an incredible action. That means it doesn't enter Yosef's mind that they might get upset about the fact that he's been elected king. He's being mochiach. He's trying to use that fact as a means of getting them to shake themselves up, getting them to back up. That's security. That's kingship. He's not worried about his own position. He's not worried about losing his position, that they're going to catch up with him. He's not in business. He's in the business of kingship. In the business of kingship, you don't worry about competition because you have security. You're there for good. You've made it and you're there to stay. And nobody can touch you. Once nobody can touch you, your whole relationship with the world is different. You don't feel threatened by anybody. You don't get ferribled at anybody. You don't talk Lashon Hara about anybody. What's the point? You're ahead and you're there to stay. What's there to do? Malchus is that security that results in a completely different relationship with the world. One where there's no feeling of being threatened. Malchus is a generous relationship with the world. It's a relationship where you can afford to give and to give and to give, and you're never worried about somebody else doing you in as a result of it or catching up. What they want, what Am Yisrael want, is a king who knows that it's his forever, because they appreciate that that's what you need for a king. And that's the midah that Yosef had. Before we come back to Yosef, so what did Shmuel find so despicable about that request? The Mephoshim say various things. The one thing the Mephoshim say is that they asked for a king, not just to judge them, but also one who would go out before them. Somebody that would fight for them and so on. That's very difficult to say that that's the pshat, because it doesn't say so. Simran amelech l'shofteinu k'chol ha'goyim. Some say it's the fact, and there's a Gemara to support this. Some say it's the fact that if they would have just said, we want a king like all the other nations, that's alright. But they said, L'shofteinu k'chol ha'goyim, that he should judge us like all the other nations. And they seem to imply in there that they want to be judged the way other kings judge their nations. That's very difficult, although there's a Gemara to support it, but the Gemara can be learned in several ways. That's very difficult for the following reason, because Shmuel tells us exactly what he's worried about. Vayera hadavar be'enei Shmuel. Shmuel finds the thing bad. Kasher omru, this that they said, t'na lanu melech l'shofteinu, give us a king to judge us, and he stops there. So we see that what's disturbing Shmuel is not the kechol ha'goyim. Most of them, Mephoshim, learn it on the kechol ha'goyim, the fact that they wanted to be judged like the other nations, but that doesn't seem to be what Shmuel's worried about. He's worried about the essential request. T'na lanu melech l'shofteinu, give us a king to judge us. What's wrong with that? Says the Klayoko, one word. The use of lanu instead of aleinu. A king to us instead of a king over us. Shmuel detected that in their request they wanted somebody they could manipulate. That's it. And in fact one could then learn this as a reaction against his sons. While Shmuel was the Novi and he used to come to them, they felt as if they could manipulate him. Really they knew they couldn't, but still that if the shofet comes to me to be judged, you know, okay, you feel on equal terms with the shofet, you don't feel threatened by him. But now all of a sudden these new youngsters, they're taking over and we've got to go to them. That's a little bit more difficult to relate to. That's a bit more difficult to manipulate. When they're in our areas, we can do things with them. But if we have to go to Be'er Sheva, that's very little, gives us very little opportunity to manipulate. And Shmuel detects in the word Lanu, we want a king, one of our men, Not one of these people who keep themselves so distant, they keep themselves in a palace in Be'er Sheva. Forget it. We want somebody who comes around like you did, and it should be Lona, one of us. Say, Shmuel, that's no good. That wasn't the intention in the Torah. When the Ribbono Shel Olam says you can have a king, what does he say? When the time comes, you'll say, V'asino olai melech, let me put a king over me. That's alright. You want a king to motivate you. You want a king to push you, to guide you, to direct you. That's fine. But not a king for you to manipulate. That's not acceptable. So we see that the idea we've developed is in fact correct. That what the king needs is absolute security. He's got to be in an unassailable position where he cannot be manipulated, nor can he ever be removed from office. What they wanted is a king that can be manipulated. That's opposite to what the Torah allows them to have. That's what Kli Yaakov says, and that's ingenious, and it appears to be very beautiful and correct. What does one do if one isn't the king? Very simple. Let's just see how the brothers related to Yosef. Yosef didn't dream that the brothers would relate badly to this. He's telling them a fact that it's not right that I'm the one who's being appointed the king here. I'm one of the youngest, and you should all be ahead of me. Why have I overtaken you? Back up. What do they do? Do you think you're going to rule over us? Do you think you're going to have control over us? So they hated him more because of his dreams and his words. The brothers of Yosef were wonderful people and they were great people. There's one middah that Yosef had that his brothers didn't have. Even Yehuda really didn't have that middah at this stage. That's the middah of Malchus, kingship. Because if they were kings as well, wouldn't have worried them. Yosef's no threat to them. They would have loved him for it. Thank you for letting us know what you dreamt of, Yosef. No, that's not what they say. It eats them up. Vayachalom Odin, it happens again. And again they criticize him. Vayekanu voyechov. And his brothers are jealous of him. Jealousy is a sign that there's no kingship. It can't be jealousy and kingship. Va'oviv shomar is hadavah. But his father, no. Yaakov noted it and remembered it. This is something worthy of noticing. Malchus expresses itself in the not only tolerance of others, of competitors, but in fact a love for competitors, because they're one of Am Yisrael. What can they do to me? I'm a king, can't assail me, therefore I must love them like I love everybody else. A lack of Malchus, a lack of this aristocracy, of this nobility, expresses itself in a hatred and a jealousy for competitors. It's a different middle altogether, it's a different characteristic altogether. If a person is insecure, what does it mean to be insecure? It means that what he's got is not his own. That's what it means. What he's got is not his own, and is afraid it will be taken away from him. If what you've got is your own, what are you afraid of? What are you insecure about? If I own my house, I don't owe any money on my house. There's nothing to feel insecure about. It's insured. So what can happen? So a bomb drops in it, so we build another one. Not a problem. If the building society owns my house, there's insecurity. What happens if I can't afford the bond repayment? It's different. If I have something which is mine and I deserve it, there's nothing at all to be worried about. If I am a melech, if I am a king, that means I'm unassailable. What I've got is mine forever and it can never be removed from me. There's security. Where there's security, there's confidence. Where there's confidence, there's an ability to handle competitors. And when there's ability to handle competitors, there's an ability to see over their heads. One of the things that keeps us small and down is the fear of competitors. We're afraid, what's he doing? If I do this, what will he do? If I do that, what will he say? And so I land up doing the most mediocre things to try and satisfy the majority of people. Because if I do something outstanding, he'll say something against it. And if I do something else outstanding, he'll say something against it. And if I do a third thing outstanding, he'll try and catch up with me and break me. So what should I do? Just keep a low profile and do ordinary little things, the same as everybody else is doing, and then I'm safe. But not if you're a king. If you're a king, you're unassailable. You go ahead, you do what you believe is right, and what can happen? It's yours. What brings about security? The Mishnah tells us that there are three things that are metziyanis ha'adam min ha'olam. Three things that remove you from the world, that just drive you crazy. Hakino, hakovod, v'hataiva. The three things are jealousy, honor, and lust, desire. What's the common denominator among these three things? Very simple, they're all external. Kino means he has something that I want. It's not enjoying something I've got, he's got something and I want it. Covet, I want him to give me honor. It means I can't be happy without him. In the case of kino, I can't be happy until I've got what he's got. In the case of covet, I can't be happy unless he gives me honor. And in the case of taiva, I can't be happy unless my body's desires are fulfilled. In this case, we see the body also as an outsider. It's not something internal. If you have a need to fulfill the desires of a bodily nature, that need is external to your real self. That's not part of your decision-making process. It's not part of your neshama. It's not part of your intellect. That's something outside. That's something that, in fact, distorts your intellect. You'll start rationalizing things which aren't honest in order to give your body what it wants. So we regard the needs of the body as something outside one's real essential needs. Those three things remove one from the world. So we have the principle here. Insecurity is, as we said, when the things you've got, you depend on others for. That's it. It's not yours. You can be sacked. You can be kicked out. It can be removed from you. What gives me pleasure? Honor. It's nice to have a lot of people coming to a shir. It's a feeling of wonderful honor. If that's what gives me pleasure, I must be insecure. What? Are there going to be people next week too? What's going to happen if nobody comes next week? And if there's a major speaker comes to town next week, I must cancel the shir. Because I don't want to come here. There are three people sitting over here. I feel bad. So I must be in a constant state of insecurity. Kino, I need what he's got. So what must I do? I must get it from him. That's no good. Taiva. Constantly, I need something else, I need this, I've got to eat this, or I've got to do that, whatever it is. It's a constant pursuit for things outside of me, instead of dwelling on the things and enjoying the things that are inside me. The result is also one that must lead to denigration, must lead to Lashon Hara. You know, we've often talked about the fact that bad midas, one must see the root of them. If one's talking Lashon Hara about a particular person, you must just question yourself, not about the Lashon Hara. You must question a little bit deeper. What's really causing you to talk Lashon Hara about this? It's usually insecurity. You've got to denigrate him. Why? Because you've got to avoid him from taking away from you what you've got. That's all it is. So you've got to belittle him. You've got to make him as impotent as you can. You've got to make him ineffectual as far as you can, because he's a threat. And in a situation where there's a threat, you've got to eliminate the threat. That's how threats are handled. We eliminate them. How do you eliminate them? By Lashon Hara and denigration. That's what must be done with insecurity. But where there's security, it just makes no difference. The security is by seeing that the three things, those three examples of fulfillment external to oneself, don't exist. But that's not where one's fulfillment comes from. Not from kino, not from kovod, not from taiva. Where does your fulfillment come from? Things that you've got. That's really very simple. Quantity is something you can never have enough of. If you're a quantitative person, then you can never have enough, and you're always dependent. If I'm a quantitative person, then I must count how many people there are at the shir tonight, and if there are more than there were last week, I must know we're getting somewhere. Things are improving. If I'm a qualitative person, I must go home and analyze the shir this week, and analyze the shir last week, and work out which was a better one. And if this week's was a better one, I'm satisfied, then I'm progressing. If last week's was a better one, there's something wrong. What caused it? That's what a qualitative person does. A quantitative person can never have enough, therefore he's always dependent. A quantitative person will always suffer from kino. If you've got something that I haven't got, it must eat me up. And I must do something about it. I've got to get it away from you some way or other. Either by denigrating you, or by killing you, or by stealing it from you. I've got to get it away from you. If I'm a quantitative person, covet is essential to my fulfillment. The more people that acknowledge me, the more alive I feel. That's in fact my source of feeling alive. I only feel alive when I'm acknowledged as being alive. And taiva the same. The more I can have, the more I can accumulate, the more fulfilled and the more alive I feel. Not so with a qualitative person. A qualitative person listens to, learns one little Rashi and a piece of Chumash, and he works on it and works on it and works on it until he understands it. Now I've got it. And he goes a little bit further into it. He goes as far as he can go until he's sweating with exertion. Until he's really got as much as he can, and then he asks and he runs to this one and that one and that one to make sure that he's understood the Rashi as far as he is intellectually capable of understanding it. And then he closes his Chumash and he goes to bed. But does he go to bed with a good feeling? He's got something that nobody can ever take away from him. He understands a piece of Torah. clearly, to the best of his ability. And he doesn't depend on anybody for that. He doesn't need anybody for that. And it can never be taken away from him. It's his forever. And that feeling of fulfillment is also his forever. It will never be taken away from him. So what's going to happen now? Somebody else comes to him and says, look, can you tell me pshat in this Rashi? If he's a quantitative person, he's got to feel, you know, if I tell him the real pshat in the Rashi, then he won't, you know, then it's finished and he doesn't have to come back to me. I'll tell him half the pshat. And next week I'll tell him some more. That will keep him coming back to me. But if he's fulfilled in himself, if he's worked on quality and he's got it and he understands it, only with pleasure. He'll want to tell everybody about it. He'll want to spread it and give of himself and give of what he's learned because it doesn't detract from him. I have to arrange that all these things. One finds with the king too, the melech, the three things he's warned against are exactly the three things we've been talking about. The first one, susim, power, covet. A king's honor, a king's potency in the world is measured by his army. Says the Torah, an army must be unimportant to you. Next one, taiva, lust. Women must be unimportant. The accumulation of women, unimportant. The next one, kino. You want material things which somebody else has got and you want it, kesef. That must also be unimportant to you. These three things, quantitative accumulation, have to be unimportant to a king. If quantitative accumulation is important to a king, whether it's accumulation of wives, horses, or money, it makes no difference. If quantitative accumulation is important to a king, he is dependent on his society. He's got to bow down to them, he's got to succumb to them to make sure that the money comes in, and that the women come in, and that the army gets bigger. It's only the man who's above that, really, it's not important to him. He needs an army, he'll have an army. He needs a few wives, he'll have a few wives. He needs a bit of money to run the country, he'll have as much money as he needs. But this is not what he thinks about. That's not the source of his fulfillment. The source of his fulfillment is the Sefer Torah which he writes. They tell the last thing he's got to do is write the Sefer Torah. And he has to sit and read it and learn it and learn it and read it whenever he's not doing anything else. He carries the Sefer Torah around with him everywhere. And he opens it whenever he's got a spare moment and he learns. That's where his fulfillment has to come from. And now we find that although the Torah is talking about a king, the Torah is talking about every one of us. You want to be a king? You want malchus? Very simple. That means you've got to raise yourself above your society. That means you've got to be able to see over their heads. You've got to see clear horizons. Get away from the landmarks. Get into new areas where there are no landmarks. All you need to do is make sure that you're learning with a Rebbe, that you've got somebody who has a tradition, that you're holding on to that tradition carefully, and that you're constantly checking back to make sure that the area in which you're exploring and the direction you're taking is not contrary to that tradition. And then you can break new areas, provided that you're unassailable. To be unassailable means that accumulation of anything, accumulation of facts, accumulation of money, accumulation of anything, is just unimportant. What's important to you is a qualitative appreciation that what you do well. And I always say, one would be much better off being a good dustbin cleaner than being a bad bus driver. And one would be better off being a good bus driver than being a bad lawyer. And one's better off being a good lawyer than being a bad rabbi. And one's better off being a good rabbi than a bad Talmid Chochem. One's better off being a good Talmid Chochem than a bad Godel Hador. Each person has to see that the area in which he's operating in, he's competent in. And he mustn't go beyond that area. The Peter principle is something which in Torah one finds all the time. That is, the area where you're operating in has to be one of competence. And that's why I always say, you know, if a person, you very often find, a person is pushed into a position or into a profession for which he's not suited. And here the result is incompetence. The result of incompetence, insecurity. If I'm incompetent at my job, I must be constantly insecure. Why am I being left there? Because the boss likes me. I've got to make sure that he never gets to dislike me. If I ever say something which makes him angry, I lose my job. If I'm competent, I have the concept of malchus. If I'm competent, the quality is there, I know I'm the best for the job. There's a certain stature, there's already a certain level of operation which is unassailable. And rather be a dustbin cleaner and operating on that level than be a big tycoon that needs the banks and needs the building society, needs everybody's good vibes to be able to continue operating. Because the moment they decide to turn the taps off, they turn the taps off and you're done. And if that's the case in day-to-day professions, how much more so is it the case in Torah, where a rov gets into a position where he's incompetent and he says things which are not right and he does things which stem from his own insecurity? There you have destruction. There you have terrible, terrible destruction. Because then you have destruction of others. Then you have denigration of others. And that can never be allowed. Such a rov would be far better off as a dustbin cleaner or a lawyer or an accountant, learning 5 hours a day, 6 hours a day, 9 hours a day. But he would feel unassailable. He would feel confident. He would know that he's got his panosa, and he's got his job, at which he's good, and he's learning Torah and he's teaching Torah, and that's wonderful. But for a person to go into realms of leadership, where he needs people to convince him that he's satisfactory in that leadership, there you have situations which become incredibly dangerous, harmful to him, harmful to the people around him, and harmful to a community. What one has to aim for is a level of total competence in what one's doing. The ultimate, of course, is competence in being a Talmid Chacham. The ultimate is that you should be able to sit and learn Yomam V'Laila and be good at it. That's the best that one can possibly have, obviously. But if that's not possible, if that's not practical, then other levels of competence. What you do, the Rashi you learned, you know well, it's the best you can do. The laning you did for Shabbos was perfect, there was no mistake in it. The Gemara you prepared for the Shir, you know as far as you can possibly know it. Then you have a feeling of malchus, then you know you're making progress, then you know what you're doing is good. When you go to your work in the morning, you know you're going to do a good job of work. When you come home and you sit down, you know you're eating a supper which is well deserved. When you go off to the shir, you know you're going to gain from the shir and you're going to grow out of the shir. When you come home to your chavrusa and you learn, you know you're going to exert yourself to the full. And when you go to bed at night and you say Shema Yisrael, you say it with kavona, knowing that your day has been worthwhile. You haven't had to bow down to anybody. You haven't had to kowtow to anybody. You've achieved what you've done through your own efforts. That's what the Olam Hazeh is all about. The Ribbono Shel'Olam has put us here so that he shouldn't have to dole anything out to us in the future. That what he gives us is the things we've deserved, and things that nobody can take away from us.